Thank you for listening to the Missio Dei Uptown podcast. We are a church committed to our neighborhood, seeking to love and serve our beautifully unique community as we join God as He makes all things new. To learn more about us, visit mduptown.com.
My name is Jimmy. I am one of the pastors here this morning. You just met our other pastor, Tiana, as well. And we are so grateful that you've chosen to spend your Sunday morning with us, weathering all sorts of weather, right? Fun times. Now, if you have not been with us, or if you have a short memory, I won't call any of you out, we have opened our year discussing the realities of biblical hope. We have gone in different places in the Bible where they talk about hope, and we have really explored, like, what is the difference between cultural hope and biblical hope, and what does it look like to really root ourselves in this idea of hope? In what, or rather, in whom do we have our hope? And I am so glad we did that, that we, in God's providence, began this year in hope, because we have been reminded early this year and often this year that our world is not as it ought to be. But still, I know, and I'm so glad that we're talking about the fact that we have reason to believe and hope that it will get better, with this hope being rooted in a good and powerful God. And I'm going to be honest, hope is like easy to talk about. It's different than some other topics that maybe get brought up in church, because after I preach on hope, no one is coming to me and being like, man, I really wish you'd stop talking about hope, right? That's like not a thing people say. But I'm going to be honest, I think some of us need to be a little bit more uncomfortable with hope, at least the idea of hope. Because I think the reality is, as nice and as flowery as it sounds, hope in practice can be uncomfortable. It can be uncomfortable because I think it makes you acknowledge your current reality, right? You have to be honest about what's happening, but also because it makes you invest in the here and now, hoping that one day it will get better. Truthfully, the seasons that the Bears are bad in are way easier for me, right? I have like no emotional investment in the team. I don't have to care if a 4th-and-4 53-yard throw is completed, right? Because they're going to be bad anyways. I don't feel the stress and anticipation of whether or not overtime is going to go well for us. And so that makes us realize that hope is hard, right? And different thinkers over the years have agreed with me that hope can be hard and even potentially not worth it, according to them. Consider the Greek philosopher Epicurus. He said, do not spoil what you have by desiring what you do not have. Do not spoil what you have by desiring what you have not. Which I think that there's wisdom in that, truthfully, but I think if it's taken to its logical conclusion, it really squashes any idea that we should be people who hope for something better. Or consider the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche, right? I always say his name wrong. He says, hope in reality is the worst of all evils because it prolongs the torments of man. Yeah. And honestly, there's some truth to this. I don't know if he's always wrong. The Bears, as fun as they were this year, tormented me, right? I lost years this year. And so if Nietzsche is at least partially right, that hope contributes to the torment of people, why hope? Why choose to give our hearts to a reality that feels like it might not come? Why, instead of opening ourselves to more pain, don't we just give in to the realities we face and give up thinking it could be better? Why not? Now, I do think outside of that being dark, let me ask you this. What if instead we consider the fact that the tension we feel in hope is for a reason? What if God has made hope to be hard in practice, not hard to talk about, but in practice, because it grows us in ways we don't even realize? And I believe this is the case. I believe that God, as a good, good father, and that's important to know that he is good, has made hope to be an experience that does more than make us think about the future. It grows us to be people who can handle that future. And so this morning, I want to show you what I mean by exploring one word. It's a Hebrew word that very often the Old Testament translates as hope. But before we do that, let me pray for our time. Lord, I thank you for your word. I thank you for just the opportunity to dig in with one another, to nerd out about some Hebrew. But even in sometimes in that nerding out, Lord, you change hearts. So Lord, I just pray that you expand our hearts this morning, that we can recognize that yes, hope can be hard, but it is worth it because it is true what we hope in. So Lord, this morning I pray that I am not about my glory, my fame, my name, not the name of Missio Dei Uptown, but I'm about your name, your glory, your fame alone. So Lord, I pray that you help me tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. In your son's name I pray, amen. Now, the word we're going to explore was from our passage this morning. It's, like I said, it's from the Old Testament, often translated as hope. So let's go ahead and bring up Isaiah 40, 31. It says, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. Or if we're looking at the Hebrew, it's those who kavah in the Lord. Everybody say kavah. Kavah. This word, that's good. That was a good little at the end. I like that. Kavah appears 49 times in the whole Old Testament, and it has a few different words it is translated to, but predominantly it is often translated as wait or hope. So if anytime you see in the Psalms, like the psalmist writing, I will wait on the Lord, that's usually what it's translated to. But I am not interested in how we translate the word into English, because like I've said, we use the word wait, we use the word hope for a lot of different things. I am far more interested in the Hebrew word itself. And in particular, I'm going to nerd out a little bit this morning. I'm interested in its origin. You see, the verb kavah is a denominal verb. Denominal verb. What that means is that it is a verb that has been formed from a word that was originally a noun. And so if you think about the idea, we do this all the time. We make nouns into verbs. I Googled it. Right? That originally comes from the company Google. We transformed it into a verb. I Googled it. Or I texted you. Right? Again, the text was the noun there, and we were like, okay, let's just make this a verb so that we can just sort of speed up language. I texted you. We are texting. That is a denominal verb. And so kavah is a denominal verb. It was a verb, just like Googled, that comes from a noun. So what is kavah, a denominal verb of? Kav. Pretty easy, right? But when you see what it is a denominal verb of, it gets a little bit confusing. So a kav is a measuring line or a measuring cord. In other words, back in the day, and we do this sometimes too. Someone like David would know this better. But what they would do is they're like, okay, I want to cut a bunch of 18-inch pieces of wood. So I'm just going to like have an 18-inch string, and I'm going to hold it. I'm going to pull it tight. I'm going to mark it, cut it. Mark it, cut it. So then even if I'm like an 1/16 of an inch, we don't do 1/18 for an inch. See, I knew that, David. If I'm like 1/16 of an inch off, at least they're all the same length for the house or whatever I'm building, right? So that's a kav, is the measuring line. We still kind of use these in our current context. My mom used to run the Little League. It's not a Little League league. She used to run Little League in my hometown, and we would have this string that was 60 feet long. And so and it had a nail on it, and there was always a nail right at the bottom of home plate, and you'd put the nail there, and you'd take it, you'd line it out all the way to first base, and then we'd redig first base every single year. And then you'd take it, line it up all the way to third base, do the exact same thing. And then once you've dug, you take it to second base, you take it to second base, and you make sure that you have an exact diamond, right? So that's what a kav would be the rope that we're still using. Now, the thing is, what's really important for this kav is that if it is not entirely stretched out, it is not doing its job, right? So think about it. If I'm taking this rope and I'm only like, I'm not like stretching it to its tensest part, to its farthest part, then the reality is that my measurement's going to be off because I'm not allowing it to do its job. And so you always need to make sure that the kav was stretched. That'll come be important here in a minute. But that is the noun that the verb kavah comes from. And so kavah originally meant to do what you would do to the kav. You would kavah a kav. I know this is a little confusing, but we'll get there. In other words, you make it taut. That's what the verb would mean, right? You make it tight. You kavah the kav. You guys with me? Okay. Let me remind you exactly why I'm talking about this. This verb, this denominal verb, to make a cord tight, is the verb that is often translated as to hope or to wait. And it is translated that way because the Hebrew word came to mean that before the Old Testament was written. So it wasn't like the Old Testament writers chose to use this word for hope, and then we were like, oh yeah, that's cool. No, it already came to mean that. But why did people start to use this word, kavah, to mean to hope? What is this sort of overlap, your Venn diagram of what it mean, what is similar, yes, kavah, what is similar to hope in, and what is similar in to measuring with a rope? Well, a rope or a string or whatever kind of cord you are using, like I said, it is tightened to its healthy length. And when you do that, there is created a potential energy that powers the restoring force when the string is released. There's a lot of science words. In other words, we call this potential energy tension, right? There's tension in the rope. The kav was made to be in tension. The purpose of the cord is to be taut, is to be tight. So though there exists energy that wants to return to a resting phase, the reality is this is the purpose of the kav, to be kavah, to be intention. And of course, there's a possibility of the cord being in a bad tension of state. You can overextend the kav so that it breaks, or if the kav already has a weak spot, if it's already weak in a spot, it breaks easily. But under good care of its user, the kav fulfills its purpose when it is kavah, when it is tight. And this is precisely where they overlap. See, hope can be seen as a state of tension, a state of stretching out the person who is in need of hope, right? Hope can be seen as a state of anticipation. See, let me remind you, I do not hope for something that I already have, right? If I am sitting in front of a plate of pizza, I do not say, I really hope I get pizza tonight, right? That would be kind of wild. You may say you're excited for the pizza, but the tension of whether or not you get the pizza does not exist. And so hope is not necessary. So Paul, when talking about hope in Romans 8, says it this way: "For in this hope we were saved, but hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have?" And so the tension of hope is the reality, again, that we experience our world not as it ought to be, and that there is something in us that knows we were made for more. That's the tension. Something in us that longs for better days. Something that anticipates the arrival of better. And so in the tension, we ourselves are stretched. And we feel the tension in our current situation. And so we are invited to kavah. And just as the kav was made to kavah, so too do I believe that we were made to hope. We were made to hope, to live in the tension. And I believe that our purpose is found in the stretching. Our purpose is found in the stretching. Think about it like this. Let me give you one more example. A guitar string. It does not fulfill its purpose unless it is fully stretched and tuned, right? If you have a loose guitar string, you cannot make music. And I think sometimes in the same ways, if we do not experience some of this tension, We can't make the music that we were intended to for the Lord, right? And let me remind you, Ephesians 2, there's this whole beautiful passage. It tells us who we were, who we are now in Christ. And at the very end, instead of talking about who we are just already identity-wise, Paul then invites us, because of our identity, he invites us into something better. He says, you are the Lord's workmanship. And that word there he used, instead of work for workmanship in Ephesians 2:10, is the word poema, which is where we get the word poem from, right? He's saying, you are the Lord's poem. You are the Lord's song, right? And you, in the tension, were made to sing. You, in the tension, were made to be beautifully written, right? And so that's what it means to kavod. That's why the Hebrew writers or the Hebrew readers would know that the word kavod, to be in tension, is the same thing as a state of hope. And I'll talk about this a little bit at the end, but I think sometimes when we think about tension, because of our experiences here on earth of being disappointed, we think of tension as an innately negative thing. But the Hebrew readers and the Hebrew writers, they saw it as a positive reality, that in the tension, we can sing out a little bit more, right? Now, truth be told, I'm gonna be honest, I think this sounds really cool. Our purpose is found in the stretching, right? And while it is true, I think that the substance is not necessarily there yet. See, I think you could feel, if I could just cut it off right now, and some of you maybe hope I do, but I'm not. And I think you would leave here feeling motivated. My purpose is found in my stretching, right? But unless you are anchored to something bigger, this ends up just being an empty platitude for motivational speakers. And I'm not here to motivationally speak. So what I want to do with the rest of my time is answer the question of why. Why can hope feel so tense? Why has God made it hard? And what is the outcome of that tension? And I want to give you two reasons this morning as to why I think God has made it this way. First one is that there is power in weakness. Go with me back to the passage that was read for this morning. It says, do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. I love reading this passage after we have a better understanding of the word that they use for hope, particularly that it is cultivated in tension. Because when we understand this, it then makes sense when God would say, like, call you to hope. It would make sense that he would talk to them in their fatigue, right? In their weakness. And he reminds them, I will renew you. I will give you energy, renewal, and deliverance from exhaustion, because those are felt needs, aren't they? When we are sitting in a place where we need hope, when you live in the tension between the real and the desired, the exhaustion is real. So it makes sense, at least for me, that God is highlighting that those who hope in him, he will renew their strength. And this is not just a pattern that is highlighted in Isaiah 40, but I think it is one that permeates the scriptures. The pattern is that when we are at our weakest, God's strength works best in us. While this exists in many parts of the scripture, first, just consider consider who God calls to do particular things. Moses could not speak, asks him to speak to the most powerful man in the world. And God says, I will be with you. AKA, in your weakness, I will be strong, right? Jeremiah was like, I can't be a prophet, I'm too young. In your weakness, God says, I will be made strong, I will be with you. Time and time and time again. And then it continues in the New Testament. Look with me at the most direct explanation of this we have from Paul in 2 Corinthians 12. He says, therefore, talking about his own life, in order to keep me from being conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Or another way to think of it is, for when Paul was weak, God in him was strong. You see what Paul's saying in here? That though there are some difficulties he is facing that are causing him to feel weak, he relishes in them because God's power is being made perfect in his weakness. In other words, Paul realizes that when God works through Paul's weakness, it is only God that can get the glory in that situation, right? Paul can't walk away and be like, well, I know I'm really weak at that, but did you see that, right? It's like very clearly God working in him in that scenario, and very clearly in our weakness, God does work. He celebrates the reality that God working through him does not give him a reason to brag, but it gives him a reason to all the more bask in the glory of God and how good and perfect and gracious he is. And I do want to say this, just to clarify, like, I don't think that every bad or hard thing we go through is directly from God. I think God allows it, but it's not like God punishing us at every turn. And so I don't think he does this all the time so that we can be made weak for his glory. But the struggle does remind us that we are not God, and that our obedience, our victories in weakness, are entirely because he is working in us through the Holy Spirit. And I'm going to be honest. I don't know about y'all, but when life is easy, when life is comfortable, when life is going all the ways I want to go, it is incredibly easy to turn inward. It is incredibly easy to believe that everything that I get is because of who I am, right? Well, I've worked hard. I've pulled myself up. I deserve this. I deserve, right? And our desires in that deserving, I believe our desires for praise, our desires for power, for whatever we want, become stronger and stronger until they are insatiable. You look at anyone who's in particular spots of leadership in our country, and you can see some hide it better than others, right? Some don't hide it at all. But you can see they want the FIFA Peace Prize because it makes them feel good, right? Like, let's be real. The more you lean into that power, the more you want that power. It is so easy, in the comfortable, to believe that we are at our best when we are reliant on ourselves. But the reality is, what if some of the hardness of hope, some of the tension we exist, is to remind us of our limitedness, to remind us of our weakness, and to remind us in that weakness that we are actually at our best when we are reliant on God, when we can only rely on God? Because I believe it. Let me tell you, we are at our best when we lean into our reliance of God. I came across a quote this week from John Calvin. He highlighted the goodness of this reality, that we are closest to God in our weakness. He said, "For then do we make room for Christ's grace, when in true humility of mind, we feel and confess our own weakness." This is a good part. "The valleys are watered with rain to make them fruitful, while in the meantime, the high summits of the lofty mountains remain dry. Let that man, therefore, become a valley who is desirous to receive the heavenly rain of God's spiritual grace." I love this idea that when we are at our lowest, that is when we are rained on the most by God's grace. I think this is a beautiful picture for that phrase, "When I am weak, then I am strong." I think in the tension, part of the reason of the hope, that hope is full of tension is because we are made to live in the valley of dependence on God and not on the mountaintop of our own achievements. But how do we live out of this weakness? Let me ask you that. How do we live out of this weakness? Because I think it's a beautiful idea, but then you're like, oh, when I'm living out of my weakness, I don't get as much praise, right? When I'm living out of weakness, I might not get that promotion because I'm not always talking about how great I am. How do we do that? I think the reality is we look no further than Jesus. In their book, The Way of the Dragon or The Way of the Lamb, Jamin Goggin and Kyle Strobel say it this way. Embrace of weakness is patterned after the way of Christ, who took up his cross, holy and dependent upon the Father for life and strength. Just as Jesus found his life in the Father by the Spirit, so now do we. Embrace of weakness is patterned after the way of Jesus. It is only in modeling our lives after Jesus, relying on Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, that we can truly believe in and live out of this weakness. Okay, so that is only part one of talking about why hope is hard, that there is power in weakness. The second reason as to why hope is so hard, I want to explore is this. I believe it expands our desire for God. Let me ask you this. What if being stretched in the tension or being kavah were being stretched as if we were a slinky? Y'all didn't know I was going to talk about slinkies this morning, but we're bringing it back. We're talking about slinkies. Who here, you guys remember slinkies, right? Who here has stretched a slinky as far as I can just to see how far it would go? Are you guys have a childhood? Like, what are we doing? You didn't like have your brother go down the stairs while you held one in and he held the other. And it was a game of like, yeah, we want to see how far this stretches, but we're also going to see who lets go first, right?
Yeah.
He always let go first. I was the sucker. Well, have you ever stretched a slinky so far, like too far? Do you know what happens? Next page. It does not return to its original form, right? It cannot return to its original form. What if we weren't intended to return to our original form after the tension? What if instead we were being expanded in a way that it would allow us to know more, go deeper, and experience more of God's love? This is what 4th century theologian Gregory of Nyssa explored in a theological idea he called epictasis. Epictasis. Yes. I love referencing guys with one name. It's just so cool. It's like, oh, my friend Greg? Yeah, he calls it epictasis. The most basic definition of epictasis is a perpetual stretching of the human soul toward God. Right? So just like a slinky, we are stretching ourselves, so we cannot return to our original form. And the passage that old Greg here tied most closely to this idea was Philippians 3. He says this, Paul says this in Philippians 3. Not that I have already obtained all of this or have already arrived at my goal. So Paul is talking about like, I have not become perfect. I am not perfect. He says, I press on to take hold of that for which Jesus Christ took hold of me. Brothers and sisters, I do not consider myself yet to have taken hold of it, but I do one thing, forgetting what is behind and stretching toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus. And Greg explained, I gotta stop calling him Greg, Gregory of Nyssa, he explained that this straining toward what is ahead is a continual growth of Paul toward knowing and understanding God more and more. Another passage I think that talks about this is 2 Corinthians 4. And I really think that this is our most suited passage, even in light of what's going on in our world. Paul here says this, therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, and we are outwardly wasting away, are we not? Yet inwardly we are renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us eternal glory that far outweighs them all. You see what Paul is saying? Though we are beaten and bruised on the outside, though it is hard to hope in the context of 5-year-old children being detained by ICE. It is hard to hope in the context of people who are just protesting being shot in the chest. 10 shots. It is hard to hope in the context of the vice president justifying it and saying that we didn't see with our eyes what we saw. It is hard to hope in that tension, and yet we do not lose heart. We do not stop hoping because we know in the tension of hope, we are being stretched in ways that allow us to stand in the presence of eternal glory one day. And that will far outweigh any problem I have on this side of eternity. You see, Gregory of Nyssa's idea of the expansion of the human soul toward God is very much a fruit of his picture of eternity. His picture of eternity, and one that I ascribe to, is that the new creation, the new heavens and new earth, are going to be a paradox, right? It's two things in tension. He says that we will be both fulfilled in every hope and desire and goodness that we have ever wanted. However many cordial cherries I want without a stomach ache. Oh, to live in that day. But he also says, we will also be realizing, Mallory didn't like my cordial cherry reference. Okay. They're so good. He also says that we will constantly be realizing that there is more to God than we could ever imagine. Constantly satisfied, constantly realizing there is more to drink from. You will eat and drink of the richest of foods and drinks to your satisfaction, and you will want more. And I mean that potentially literally, I have no idea, but more so I mean that metaphorically, that drinking from the rich well of God will be a reality. You will be satisfied, and there will always be wanting. We will always be wanting more. And I think we have this infinite appetite for goodness and love and satisfaction. We have it, and it can only be matched by an eternal God. An eternally infinite appetite can only be matched by an eternal God. And so our stretching, our existing in the tension, will not actually stop on this side of eternity, which is a wild thing. Like this growing will not stop on this side of eternity. We will experience an eternal stretching of the human soul as we encounter an eternal well of goodness and love and satisfaction of our God. And the only thing that will stop in that tension is how painful it is. That's what will stop, is that the tension, the negative aspects of tension, will go away. And so I think that this desire to hope is innate. It is innate in that we were made by God to be people who hope. And I believe it is innate because in our hoping, in our anticipation, I think the tension becomes this sort of creative and generative power that keeps us exploring and desiring good. It keeps us dreaming and planning for a future that is better than the present. And in that, it expands our capacity and ability to continue to explore the goodness of our God for eternity. But I do think, I said this already, I do think, and I'm landing the plane, I promise, that this innate desire to hope is very often transformed in our broken world into a sort of dread, isn't it? As we go up and over the hill that is ahead of us, we don't know what's on the other side. And that can be terrifying. But I think C.S. Lewis captured it best when he was wrapping up the Chronicles of Narnia. I'm going to ruin the end, Tiana, if you need to cover your ears. She hasn't read yet. And at the end of the last battle, which is the last book, the kids and Aslan, I'm saying that right? It just doesn't sound right to me. And all of their animal friends, they go on this like gallop together, which sounds so sick, honestly. They're going through the terrain, over one hill after another. And at the beginning of the gallop, they come across this huge waterfall and they halt, and the kids halt to a stop. But an animal urges them to continue, and they do, further up and further in. And then the kids, as they are running again, they take stock. And I want to read for you a little bit of this passage. So all the kids are talking to one another
And it starts this. This is absolutely crazy. Said Eustis? Eustis. Okay, not this one. Don't read this one yet. Sorry. This is absolutely crazy, Eustis said to Edmund. I know, and yet, said Edmund. Isn't it wonderful, said Lucy. Have you noticed one can't feel afraid, even if one wants to? Try it. Eustis tries it, and by Jove, one can't, said Eustis. And so they continue. And they continue in their joy, and they're galloping with the rest, further up and further in. And again, Lucy stops to collect her thoughts, and she says this. I see, she said at last, thoughtfully. I see now. This garden is like the stable. It's far bigger inside than it was outside. Of course, daughter of Eve, said the fawn. The further up and the further in you go, the bigger everything gets. And then they finally, in their gallop, they arrive to where Aslan is. Aslan is the Jesus God character. And after exchanging some words, I want to read for you now the passage that C.S. Lewis ends with. So Aslan has just stopped talking. And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and so beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories. We can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. I think it's a beautiful picture of eternity, where we are constantly fulfilled, and yet there is even better to come. Where the tension and anticipation of what is to come is only colored by the goodness of what has already happened. Where we no longer need to hope for what we do not see, but relish in him who sits right in front of us. I am supremely convinced, then, that the hardness of hope is an invitation for us. It is an invitation to participate in the eternal stretching of the human soul toward God. It is to sit here knowing it is not how it ought to be, but it will one day be better than we can ever imagine. And this does not give us the excuse to check out of our world, dissociate from what is going on, but rather it invites us to continue to press farther up and farther in into the brokenness, knowing that we have with us the goodness of God, knowing that we have hope, knowing that in our weakness, in our stretching, in the hardness, God is made strong. We have been invited into a story that is only being written. This has only been the cover and the title page. I want to tell you that. In light of eternity, this has only been the cover and the title page. And I want to remind you, every chapter is better than the one before. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Missio Dei Uptown podcast. We are a church committed to our neighborhood, seeking to love and serve our beautifully unique community as we join God as he makes all things new. To learn more about us, visit mduptown.com.